It's a privilege to be able to be in here. This is an important lesson. It's important because of the threats which we're facing today, especially from the, some would say, the scientific community. I would suggest maybe the pseudo-scientific community. We are talking about catastrophe, and specifically the subject is analogs of catastrophe. We're going to notice a handful as we introduce. We're going to focus upon one for the lesson itself. You and I understand that the world can change, the geographic and even the geologic and even geographic world can change very quickly. I didn't realize we were this close to one of the ones that I wanted to mention. I knew that it was in Texas. And it wasn't until last night when I was talking to Justin Guess, and I said, where would this be? He said, oh, it's 20 miles that way. Wish I'd known that a few years ago, and I would have probably visited it a number of times by now. But to give you an idea of where we are located somewhere maybe right in here. And where we're talking about is right there. So not very far at all. Here's 35, San Marcos, Country Estates up there. This is Canyon Lake. Canyon Lake, and you could see here Canyon Lake Gorge. Now this Canyon Lake Gorge, if we go back to the summer of 2002, that looked nothing like that beginning of the summer. Probably some of you who are from this area will remember when this happened. But there was extended rainfall. In fact, we read here in the summer of 2002, a week of heavy rains in central Texas caused Canyon Lake, the reservoir of the Canyon Dam, to flood over its spillway and down the Guadalupe River Valley in a planned diversion to save the dam from catastrophic failure. Now, I realize you probably can't read that from where you are. That's why we'll go ahead and read that for you. I don't know why I'm trying to swipe the TV. But to give you an idea of where we're looking right here. This is the dam, but they were diverting the water because of the great amount of rain which they had had over the course of that. Some said a few days, a week. Some said several weeks. But anyway, continuing. The flood excavated just because they're trying to run it around the dam. The flood excavated a 2.2 kilometer long, 7 meter deep canyon in the bedrock. According to a new analyst, that canyon formed in just 3 days. According to a new analysis, analysis of the flood and its aftermath performed by Michael Lamb, assistant professor of geology at the California Institute of Technology, Caltech, and Mark Fonstad of Texas State here in San Marcos, the canyon formed in just 3 days. Well, you can see the great amount of change which was affected on the earth in a very short amount of time. Well, that's right around the corner, and I would love to go visit that now that I know it's this close. If you live in this area and you haven't checked it out, I would encourage going to see it. It costs $10 to be able to tour it, about a 3-hour hike, and you have a guided tour there. So it would be very interesting to see. Now, our subject is analogs of catastrophe. An analog is something having analogy with something else. And if you're like me, you love it when definitions include the word that you're defining. So to look up analogy, a similarity between like features of two things on which a comparison may be based. Now we're going to be obviously glimpsing quickly these first few, and then we're going to spend more time on the fourth of these analogs, but I would suggest we can look at these and we can look at things like the Grand Canyon, and because of the similarities of these two things, we can extrapolate that some great event with a lot of water caused not only the Grand Canyon, but other features which we have exhibited on our earth today, and that, of course, would take us back to Genesis chapter 6 through 9, and the Noahic flood, 2 Peter 3:6, the world that then was being overflowed with water perished. Just a couple of more of these analogies before we get to the one that I especially want to consider. Well, actually, let me mention this first. Why are these analogous? This is from ScienceDaily.com on the article concerning Canyon Lake Gorge. Our traditional view of deep river canyons, such as the Grand Canyon, is that they are carved slowly as the regular flow and occasional moderate rushing of rivers erodes rock over periods of millions of years. I believe everyone in the room here has heard that about the Grand Canyon. Such is not always the case, however. We know that some big canyons have been cut by large catastrophic flood events during Earth's history. Now, this article considered what happened at Canyon Lake, one of those, which during that 3 days, by the way, the amount of water that's currently in the reservoir basically would have had tripled that amount of water going through that canyon over the course of that 3 days. But in the grand scheme of things, if we were to go back to that initial picture, we're talking about, as far as this earth is concerned, that is extremely small. That's really insignificant size-wise. Some of you will remember a couple of tsunamis back in the early parts of this new millennium. 2004, the tsunami in Indonesia. This is only part of that which was affected. Not only affected Indonesia, it killed people as far away as South Africa. I believe there were 4 deaths in South Africa because of the tsunami. A 9.0 earthquake off the coast caused these great waves. Now, this is before the tsunami. This is after the tsunami. You can tell there's a great amount of geologic difference, and we would suggest geographic difference as well. Japan of 2011. I'm thinking, although I could not verify it because, ironically, there wasn't as much information as I was hoping. I believe this is the same one that messed up the Funai nuclear plant, but for some reason I was thinking that was 2010 in my mind. But that's probably, and y'all are nodding in agreement, so this must be it. But the 8.9 earthquake, which caused the tsunami, the earthquake was off the eastern coast of the northern part of Japan. But you can see the difference geologically, geographically, because of that one event. And those are pretty large, 9.0 earthquake, 8.9 earthquakes sending out these tsunamis. That's pretty massive. But again, on the global scale, still relatively small. What I want to talk about today is the analog of catastrophe, that is Mount St. Helens. In my estimation, it is the most important one of these analogs that we could consider. Number one, it is known in popular culture. Number two, as far as those of us that are in this room, it happened in the lifetime of most of us. May 18th, 1980 is when the big eruption took place. Number three, we can easily travel there. If you catch a flight to Seattle, drive south about 2.5 hours, hang a left, drive for about 20 minutes, you are at maybe about 30 minutes, but you're at Mount St. Helens. And so it's easily reachable. Number four, the changes that were affected are very broad as far as the analogies which we have. We see not only the carving of canyons, we actually have a great deal of deposition immediately following that eruption. There are stratifications, strata, in the rocks which had been laid down during the initial eruptions. You have polystrate fossils which are in the process of being formed. And we'll talk about especially those first, second, and fourth of those as we go through. But all of these are well documented. In fact, signage at other places like Yellowstone has even been affected because of the petrified forest at Yellowstone. There was the idea that these trees grew over millions of years and so forth. But the end result looks exactly as they're going to expect Spirit Lake to look in a number of years. And so they said, maybe it doesn't take that long. So beside this evolutionary signage, they have a little plaque that says, this happened in a very short time at Mount St. Helens. Maybe that's the way it happened here. So it's causing some to reconsider some of the scientific theories that are out there. I would recommend, and you can glance at these afterward and look at the information if you want to try to order some of them. I'd recommend several books. Number one, Stephen A. Austin's Grand Canyon Monument to Catastrophe. It is a great analog of the flood itself. But of course, having the basis with Mount St. Helens is going to help to appreciate that. Stephen A. Austin also wrote, along with John Morris, Footprints in the Ash. This is absolutely excellent. It is all about Mount St. Helens, and it goes into great detail about all the different ways that this serves as an analogy. There are a few other books on geology by John Morris and Carl Froude, Jr., if I'm pronouncing that correctly, Geology by Design and The Young Earth, which I would encourage you to see. And then, you know, just get some information about Mount St. Helens and see the amount of power that was unleashed during that great event. Also, if you want to check it out, this is a piece of pumice that was blown out on May 18th, 1980. And if you throw that in water, it will float because it was this bit of material shot through the air. The gases inside were expanding, and so it grew larger and larger, and probably bits of it flew off. It's nice and smooth from where it was flying through the air, but it's very light. And we'll have a picture later of a much larger piece. And you know how weak I am, or you could probably estimate, so you get an idea of how light these things really are. This is Mount St. Helens prior to March of 1980. In the foreground is Spirit Lake. We will be coming back to Spirit Lake a little later in our study. But Mount St. Helens was a beautiful, beautiful mountain. Many likened it to Japan's Mount Fuji. And you can certainly imagine with that beautiful cone structure that the similarities were, or the moniker was, well deserved. In March of 1980, the mountain started waking up. It had been well over 100 years since it had last erupted, but it had been quiet. But from that point, a number of earthquakes and small steam eruptions began to take place, and there began to be a bulge on the northern side of this mountain. Now, this is very close to when the eruption itself took place, and you can tell the very pronounced bulge there. Some of you may remember that the USGS had moved in and it set up an area where people were not supposed to be. There was a red zone and then a blue zone. We're going to see that there were a lot of deaths because of this eruption. If I remember correctly, all but two were outside of that red zone. People thought that, you know, the blue zone would be perfectly safe, and then some were even killed beyond that. But the geologists did not know what was going to take place as far as this eruption was concerned. You and I have seen enough movies through the years about volcanoes and how they work that we expect for this thing to open up that way and for everything to shoot straight up. And that's what the geologists were expecting. That's what the red zone would have accomplished if this shoots straight up. Everybody's perfectly fine, except maybe a fellow named Harry Truman. He's probably going to die either way. Some of you may remember the name of Harry Truman. Harry Truman, not the president, but Harry Truman was the owner of a lodge on that lake that was in the foreground in that previous picture. His wife had died sometime earlier. They'd been married for 30 years, and that loss had been extremely hard on him. And he determined that if the mountain blew up, he wanted to go with it because that's all he had left, that and his pink Cadillac. So it was, which had a bar in the back, apparently. I didn't know that it was large enough to have a bar in the back of a pink Cadillac, but he did. Well, here's the eruption. I draw your attention, first of all, to the upper right. This is 10 seconds after. There was actually a plane flying by, and that plane had two geologists, and they happened to notice that north slope begin to go around that same time. I think this was Reed Blackburn that took these pictures, but this was about 10 miles away, if I remember correctly, and he realized that the slope was starting to go. So we have 10 seconds after, 42 seconds after, 52 seconds after, 60 seconds after the initial earthquake, 5.0 or 5.1, depending on what source you're reading, caused that northern weakened area to collapse. Largest landslide in recorded history took place on that day. What we had was a lateral blast, not that straight up and down blast that would be expected. This would have been expected. Now, it ultimately would do that. But the initial blast was to the north, maybe a hair to the northeast. And we'll see a lot of pictures of the damage that was done. We'll see some that were taken just 5 years ago, last opportunity I had to be there at Mount St. Helens. But you get an idea of the amount of power that's being unleashed. This is the start. This is Deering really at its strength. And then this would be after, as things were winding down. This is an idea of how much of the volcano was lost. The old summit had been 9,677 feet. The new summit was 8,365 feet. So you're talking about a difference of 1,300 feet. But from where the northern face had been, the northern summit, if you will, to the bottom of what was blown out, that was about 2,500 to 3,000 feet of elevation lost. And you see the dome there in the middle. This would have been after the dome had had time to build up again. There have been many different domes as of today. One dome was almost, as it were, one great piece of granite that was called Humpback, if I remember correctly, was what they called that particular dome. When we were up there, and we'll be able to see that picture in a minute, it's still smoking. And so this is still an active volcano, although not, there's no anticipation it's going to do what it did then. Here you get an idea of what was taking place, not just here with that blast, but what's taking place with some of the sediment, melted snow, glaciers, and so forth. These things came out and went down the Lewitt Valley and went this way to Spirit Lake, sloshed up behind, we'll talk more about that, splashed back down, went through the North Fork of the Toutle River, came together in the Toutle River basin and ran well past I-5, which is, like we mentioned, about a half hour away. This is one of the canyons that was carved out. I'm not sure the exact date of this canyon. I would suggest this is probably from 1982, although I couldn't find a date for this picture. You get an idea of how large those people are, so you get a little idea of scale. But let's just go ahead and set forth that this isn't going to do justice to what those canyons are today. Farther downstream, and we'll give you some facts and figures in a few moments that help you to appreciate all of the power that was released and whatnot. But farther down the stream, you can see how high the mud flow, the lahar is what that's called, had been. Here you see what look like Tonka toys, but those are full-size logging vehicles which are just strewn about as if a child's done playing for the day and throws them off. This is Spirit Lake after that May 18th eruption with Mount Rainier in the background, but the water level of this lake at this point was 200 feet higher than it had been, probably somewhere right in here is where Spirit Lake Lodge, where Harry Truman had been, would have been located, but you'd have to go straight down 200 feet to be able to get to it, and quite frankly, it and everything else that was in that lake would have been completely blown out of that basin on that day and then would have washed back in. This gives you an idea of the scale of rocks that were dislodged. I don't know that that one necessarily would have been blown a great distance, but certainly dislodged. Another view of the type of damage cutting through canyons. And then just a general view of the landscape there. This is its current condition, or at least as of about 5 years ago, and I have no reason to believe that it's doing anything different than it was then. You can actually go online and watch the Mount St. Helens Volcano Cam, which updates about every 5 minutes. And it's interesting when 10 years ago there would be small eruptions and a lot of earthquakes to just go there, and at night sometimes you would even see the glow of the heat inside the dome. Well, let's talk about some of the figures, and then we'll notice some pictures up to date here, or more recent, I should say. This started, I mentioned, with a 5.0, 5.1 earthquake beneath that 320-foot bulge, according to National Geographic. There are different ideas exactly as to how much power was unleashed. A lot of different ideas. National Geographic said there was as much power being unleashed as 500 Hiroshimas. Now think about that. That's one of the things that ended World War II. This is 500 of those as far as the power. 50 megatons of TNT is another way I saw it expressed. There was a nuclear weapon of similar power that was tested by the USSR in 1961. There's another figure which is used in Reason and Revelation from a source called Decker and Decker. 27,000 Hiroshimas were unleashed every second. Now that sounds a lot different than 500 total. So I'm wondering if the figures are just somehow convoluted, one's using the wrong numbers or missed a decimal place or something, or if the 500 are what started the initial collapse, that 5.0 earthquake. And then you had the earth just spewing at that other great figure. Regardless, those are inconceivable, whichever you go with, inconceivable amounts of power probably for you, certainly for me. I can't imagine. And I would go ahead and add a little note. Mount St. Helens was a small volcano. On a scale of 1 to 10, it's maybe a 2, maybe a 3, probably closer to 2. Now you would think, oh, that would be massively loud. And you would think, but here, right around the volcano, people would not have heard much more than trees snapping and the sound of wind. It was actually 60 miles away before you began to hear the volcano. And that's because sound travels in waves. So you can imagine those sound waves. And the eruption was actually loudest between 150 and 200 miles away, was heard as far as 690 miles away. We mentioned the dead. There were actually 57 who were killed in this eruption. 21 were never accounted for. No telling how many fish in the rivers and lakes, thousands of animals, millions of trees. You can see in this, actually, this is the most recent Google Earth image. I screenshotted that last night. You can see how green most of this is around today. We'll zoom out on some later pictures. But most of this would have been forested very heavily until timberline, and then it would have been snow and glacier. As far as the amount of ash that would have been produced, National Geographic said 400 million tons. Now, why is that important? And I realize we're not going to have a huge amount of time, so I'll go ahead and give away one of these things. You had the canopy, the firmament, before the flood. That was water stored as water vapor in the upper atmosphere. This ash would be extremely fine, would be able to be blown up. This blew up 12 miles, and remember, this is a small volcano. You send that into that firmament, and each little piece of ash is going to be able to serve as a nucleus of condensation. And so that's going to be able to bring all of that stored water down upon the earth. But this ash flew up for 9 hours. The column was 12 miles high. To give you an idea of how wide it was, just 4 minutes in, it was already 20 miles wide. You can look at radar footage from that day, and you can see it stretched many tens of miles, perhaps even 100 miles wide, and maybe 1,000 miles to the north, and then following the wind more to the east. There was a blanket of 6 to 14 inches of pumice and ash just in this area, and that's not, you know, including that what was actually in the path of that blast in Yakima, about 30 miles away at 9:30 in the morning, darkness was that of midnight, and all of the public lights, the street lights, came on. The landslide released 3.5 billion cubic yards of material. One source said roughly to the same amount as Vesuvius in AD 79. A half cubic mile of earth, according to Think magazine. We mentioned that the initial bit that was in that lateral blast would have gone beyond Spirit Lake here, sloshed up on the back. It sloshed up 700 feet above the height of Spirit Lake there on the hills behind, and then sloshed back down. The lahars, the mud flows that went here and then came back and went through there were 80 miles an hour. 200 homes were washed away. Average depth, I'm sorry, we'll get to that in a minute. 234 square miles of forest were destroyed. 150,000 acres of private, state, and federal forests. Virtually every tree within 6 miles was just obliterated by the blast, the hurricane force winds. 6 to 14 miles away, which would have been about right here and beyond, the trees. The heat was 600 degrees, and so the trees would have been burned and blown back 14 to 18 miles away. The trees were killed by the heat, but were left standing. And you can see, still see 45 years later when these were taken, 44 years later, those trees still standing where they had been. 70% of the snow and glaciers on the mountain melted. And we might add, you know, we often hear the people that are talking about global warming saying we're losing all of our glaciers. The youngest glacier in America is actually in the crater of Mount St. Helens. So glaciers are forming even as we speak. And this is in southern Washington. This isn't way up in Canada. And so situation's not necessarily as dire as some might suggest. Three logging camps were destroyed, 22 crew buses, 30 log trucks, 39 rail cars, 12 million board feet of logs, 650 miles of roads, 19 bridges, 16 miles of railroad. I couldn't tell whether that's just what belonged to Weyerhaeuser or whether that was in general. But if that's even in general, that's an amazing amount. As far as the valley was concerned, this would not have had the channels after that initial eruption necessarily. But 2 years later, there was an eruption which sent ice and other things which had already accumulated. And today, the canyons which flow through there, particularly the Lewitt Channel, has an average depth of 210 feet. Now, we're talking about this being an analogy of the Grand Canyon. Yes, the Grand Canyon's a lot deeper than that, 6,000 feet. But that is 1/30th scale. And really, that 30th scale took place in a day, caused by a small volcano having a very small eruption in 1982. Imagine if, as the book of Genesis says, all the fountains of the great deep were opened up, and all of the water which had been above were released, how much strength there would have been. Anthropologist and philosopher Lauren C. Isley said, "If there is magic on this planet, it is contained in water." That's a great statement. The water that flowed down on that initial eruption and then in 1982 helps us to appreciate that what we see in the Grand Canyon could have been formed very quickly, especially if upstream you had a natural dam which had formed during the flood, and then somehow it broke. All that water released would have carved the Grand Canyon very quickly. There actually was a purposeful breaking of a natural dam just above the North Fork of the Toutle River because of the concern that it would cause even more damage downstream. They were releasing, I think it was 30,000 gallons of water a minute to try to help to alleviate that danger. Let's quickly go through some of the pictures. Just curious, how much time do I have? 5 minutes. All right, perfect. Okay, this is taken from Johnston Ridge. We're 5 miles away from the volcano here. This is Lewitt, and then this is that North Fork channel, North Fork of the Toutle River. Lewitt, this is where you have the 200 feet average for the size of the channels. Remember, that's average. That's not the deepest, although I could not find the measurement for the deepest part of it. You can't see it, but the newest glaciers off to the left there, you have the modern dome in the background. This is there at that 5 mile area. You can see that there's still a great amount of desolation. These rocks would have been blown out during the 1982 eruption. Now, this is on the south side, if you're climbing up the back of Mount St. Helens. Mount St. Helens, we mentioned, had a lateral blast, so it blew off this way, and then this way. So the other side was basically untouched. But even on that other side, you'll notice in these pictures that you have a lot of only younger trees, because these trees were still killed. Even though they were that close, you get an idea of what sorts of rocks. That's a little different color, but that's a big example of this. I didn't try to lift that one up. I didn't necessarily want to strain myself. But don't tell Daniel I couldn't have done it, Parker. We need to let make him think that I could. This is viewing toward the south from probably about 7,000 feet up. You can see some of the snow which hadn't yet melted. This was April, if I remember correctly, maybe May. No, this would have been May. There's a rather large piece of pumice, very light. If we were to throw that in water, it would float. There's the summit in the background. Here's a good idea of what sort of landscape you have on top, not quite on the top, but near the top of that volcano. Here's Spirit Lake today. Originally, Spirit Lake would have been just a small portion of that. You'll notice all of this brown. It would immediately look like that brown's just some sort of optical illusion or something, but those are all logs which are floating, which have been floating in Spirit Lake since 1980. There's another view here, some of the pictures of the channels. You can see even to this day, trees which have been tossed around like toothpicks, some that were killed immediately and yet still stand. Amount of power released is amazing. These are called hummocks. These hummocks, something would have caught the material as it was going by, and other material would sort of stack up around it. Those are extremely common. Moving to a different area, this and four other lakes, counting the new Spirit Lake, did not exist before the eruption of May 18th, 1980. This lake is Clearwater Lake, 3 miles long, a half mile wide, 150 feet deep, if I remember correctly. Some of the most beautiful water you're going to see. You can tell how blue it is. The picture doesn't do justice. But that lake is about 7 miles from Mount St. Helens and was created on that initial day of its blast. Here's Spirit Lake before. Moving away from the volcano, this is the path by which that blast would have gone. Here's Spirit Lake today. You would not have been able to see Spirit Lake from this vantage point. This is what it looked like immediately after. Here are those trees. Now, why is that important? All of these trees were blown off 40, now we're in 2019, 49 years ago. As these become more and more waterlogged, what's going to happen is they are going to begin to sink. Now, especially if they have a little bit, you know, more of a root end or something like that, they're going to get a little bit heavier, and they're going to end up sinking like that. And other sediment is going to settle around. If we had some pictures of underneath, we could see that's already taking place. If you've heard of polystrate fossils are fossils which cut through millions of years of rocks, according to the evolutionist. Problem with that is you can't grow a tree through solid rock, which means that tree had to have grown there or have been deposited by something like this, and the sediment have come in around it. That's what took place at Yellowstone. And so that's what's very important about what's still taking place there at Spirit Lake. This is a miner's car, a husband and his wife, and their, if I remember correctly, niece, were 8.5 miles away from the blast. This particular spot, if I can get to that specific location. 300 mile per hour was the speed of the blast at this point. It was still 400 degrees. Now, you can't see the tires. I have some other pictures where you can see the tires. They're white-walled tires. The tires did not pop. Well, that's because they were heat-treated. All the rubber and plastic inside melted, but the tires didn't pop. So that's how geologists were able to figure how hot the temperature was there. A few other pictures. Now you're... this is 8.5 miles away near that miner's car. And then one other, which I just throw up because it's really quite funny. I think that I have that one. No, I did not end it with that one. Yeah, I did. Bigfoot. Everybody hunts for Bigfoot these days. He's not going to be found because the last Bigfoot died in the eruption of Mount St. Helens. That's a monument to him. As we were driving back towards Seattle, I had this sort of feeling of deja vu, not because of Bigfoot, but because I was remembering a house that I had seen when I was a child. And I was about to say to this fellow, and I'd sort of begun to think, that's just a child's memory. It didn't really happen. I was about to say, I feel like this is where I saw a buried A-frame house. And I looked up, buried A-frame house, next left. This fella, Blair Barner, had built this house. This is 22 miles, if I remember, away from the crater. And there's what it looked like when he built it. I got to meet him, talk to him. He gave me some of the old pictures. But it was buried roughly to that level, 22 miles away. And that's not on, you know, the main stream. When it got to I-5, the sediment was reaching the bottom of the bridge at I-5. So that just gives you an idea of how terrible it was, how far away. And, you know, two birds with one stone. Now we know what happened to Bigfoot. We don't have to hunt for him anymore. But I appreciate it. Appreciate your time and attention. When we think about Mount St. Helens, it gives us a great analog to what happened at the Grand Canyon. And the Grand Canyon shows us what could happen during the flood. So that's why we wanted to deal with analogs of catastrophe. Thank you for your kind attention.